This is Neil Rockhind. Welcome to another edition of the Killer Cross-Examination Podcast. And this is an unusual episode for me. Usually we've been interviewing top flight lawyers, news-making lawyers, some experts. And today we're going to actually talk to my good friend Kevin Dietz, one of the veteran award-winning reporters, was on television for years and has done television, has done podcasts, has done, and now is the host of All Talk, which is on WJR, which is a super station here in metropolitan Detroit. And if you've driven from I-75, you're driven from Detroit all the way down to Florida, pretty much WJR 760 AM, the voice of the Great Lakes comes in almost the entire drive. It's one of the super stations all across the country. And I'm proud to have Kevin Dietz here. Kevin, welcome to the Killer Cross-Examination Podcast.
Hey, Neil, how you doing? Good to talk to you.
I'm great. So tell me about your background, Kevin, in news and in covering cases in court.
Well, I went to Western Michigan University, and I was going to go to law school. And so I studied political science, and I decided right about 2 weeks before going to Cooley Law School in Lansing to take a job in TV news in Northern Michigan. And I was a sports director in college, and I did a little bit of news reading, just kind of rip and read at the news station, but mostly sports reporting. And as soon as I got up north and got on the air, I just kind of fell in love with the whole idea of TV news. And I spent the next 30 years doing television news in cities like Sheboygan, Michigan, Traverse City, Lansing, Battle Creek, Grand Rapids, and then the last 25 years in Detroit, Michigan.
You've had a front row seat to some of the biggest cases in metropolitan Detroit. So take me back if you could. Maybe, I don't know if you can think of the first memorable case that you covered, whether it was here on television or locally or even elsewhere in Michigan. I'd love to hear the first case that made the first big impression on you.
The first big case was the Nancy Kerrigan case. She was clubbed in the knee by Tonya Harding right before going to the Olympics. And of course, the whole world was quickly watching our reports as we tried to unravel the mystery of who whacked Nancy Kerrigan on the knee. At first, they didn't have any idea who it was. And it took quite a while, actually, for them to figure it out. But the whole world was trying to figure out why someone in Detroit would go into Cobo Hall, which it was called at the time, and attack Nancy Kerrigan. We later found out it was a competitor of hers, Tonya Harding, who set up the deal and with her boyfriend, husband, hired somebody to go and take Nancy Kerrigan out so that she could make it into the Olympics and do better. It was crazy. And Detroit's always had a reputation of just having the biggest cases. A couple weeks after that, I was on a Saturday afternoon, my pager went off about a body that was found on Belle Isle, which is a small island outside of that's part of Detroit. And it was a body that Dr. Kevorkian had dropped off. So we were in the middle of one of the biggest cases, Dr. Kevorkian, going on at the same time Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan is going on. So we've had many big cases. Jimmy Hoffa covered all of the searches for Jimmy Hoffa and all of the efforts to try and find out who was responsible for that. Just through the years, many, many cases.
What was the first? So was the Nancy Kerrigan, Tonya Harding case the first big case that you covered, the first case that you were really involved in as an investigative journalist? And I should say that your roles over the years, I presume at some point you were a reporter, but of course you became well-known here in metropolitan Detroit for being an investigative reporter and then working with being one of the defenders and looking up, uncovering different cases and really having sort of an inside seat. I mean, I can think of several that you handled, but And then now on the radio, you have the chance to cover so many and talk to so many people. But was that the first case that you covered as a reporter or as a journalist or that you investigated?
I was actually a general assignment reporter when the Nancy Kerrigan, Tonya Harding case came on. My first 3 years in Detroit, I was a general assignment reporter. And then I moved to the investigative team after that. But that particular story was very much like an investigative report because you were really working hard to get sources to give you information because you were competing with international reporters. You had the whole country focused on the story. And I don't know if you remember it well or not, Neil, but the whole world kind of stopped for a moment when this happened in Detroit, and it became just a massive whodunit. So we were, we went out to the airport. We started going motel by motel, trying to find information from different people as to who checked in and who checked out. And we were getting police were giving bits of information, what the weapon was, how it went down. So I was a general assignment reporter, but that particular story we really covered like an investigation. And with the Dr. Kevorkian case, if you got assigned to one of those trials, you were in that trial for weeks, if not months, because, and again, the whole nation was watching that case as well, as that unfolded, as literally prosecutors tried to put Dr. Kevorkian in jail for assisted suicide.
How many trials do you think you've covered over the years?
Oh, hundreds. I mean, hundreds, mostly 2 and 3 day trials, but some were in the months.
What was the first case that you took part in actually being being in court day to day, where you really were covering the case in court almost full time?
Kevorkian would have been the first time, but that, you know, that goes back, but there's been so many of them, over the years. I would say more recently, Kwame Kilpatrick, who was the mayor of Detroit, I covered, his really for 7-8 years, we investigated wrongdoing with Kwame Kilpatrick, and we were certainly in court every single day for his state case and the federal case against him.
The first case that I remember being on television, being covered like gavel to gavel, so to speak, was the William Kennedy Smith case, where Roy Black defended William Kennedy Smith in that criminal sexual conduct case. I think that was in, was it in Massachusetts, or that was in Florida?
Florida.
In Palm Beach, just outside Palm Beach.
Court TV came out. I don't know what year Court TV came out, but that sort of changed things. Once Court TV came out and it was successful, a lot of the local stations started kind of doing gavel to gavel trials.
So I want to ask you about the progression of that. That's sort of what one of the reasons why I really am glad to have you on, because nowadays we're sort of spoiled in a way, I think. Maybe you disagree, and I'm interested in your take. Reporters are typically can be in the courtroom with computers, laptops, with Twitter, tweeting, threads. And we've got, obviously, you know, the Law and Crime Network. We've got Court TV, other stations, radio stations. So we can cover this stuff, you know. But that wasn't how it was when you started. There wasn't Twitter and social media. And there probably wasn't in the courtroom with a laptop. So how did you cover? I mean, tell me how it started technologically for you when you were in the courtroom covering those long trials.
Yeah, it was almost like newspaper reporting. You would go and you would spend the entire day in court. At the lunch break, you'd come out and start to formulate what your story was going to be. But the only video you had was you'd set up a camera and you'd get people walking into the court and then them walking out. And maybe a prosecutor would give you a comment after, or a defense attorney might give you a comment after, but that was really all you had to work with. So we would be in the court all day at noon while everyone else was at lunch. You'd start to formulate the story and you'd go back in, and then court would usually end around 4:30, and you had from that time till 5 or 6 o'clock to get your story written and put on air for the day.
And so there's been a, you had cameras in the courtroom for some cases in state court, but in federal court, they still don't have cameras in those long trials.
Correct. Yeah, no cameras. You now can just recently in Southeast Michigan, you can bring computers into the courtroom, so you can take notes on your computer, but you still cannot tweet out of a federal courthouse. You have to go outside and then transmit any kind of posts you want to post.
So what do you think about, do you think that having cameras in the courtroom and having the media cover cases has been helpful? Do you think it's been hurtful? Do you think there's a mixed bag?
I think it should be everywhere. I think federal courts should open up to cameras. I think it's too important for the public to see what is happening in courts. It's the work that's being done there is just too important not to be available to the public. I do think that when cameras are allowed in court, it changes the dynamics of what happens in the courtroom. There's the speeches get more animated. The judges become more interesting. When the cameras aren't there, it can be fairly mundane, as you well know. But suddenly, when the cameras are turned on, people act a little differently. It's just human nature.
Do you think that it is? Do you think that the that covering? I know that we get more animation and more liveliness in the courtroom, but do you think that it improves the rulings? Do you think that it improves the verdicts? Does it, do you see more? I think it lends to more transparency. I really do. I think that that good judges tend to be really good. I think it highlights when there are particularly bad judges. I think that it can really highlight and it can curb them to a certain degree because you're covering that every day, right? I mean, you're seeing if there's a judge who's not particularly helpful to the litigants or not, we'll call user friendly, you're covering that. In a one-day trial, maybe they'll get away with it, but in a 2 or 3 week trial like you've covered, they can't escape that because you got to have something to write. And one day it may be about the judge. Right.
No. Yeah. And when there's a camera in the courtroom, they know that the camera is rolling the whole time. And so if they're rolling their eyes, it can get picked up. If they're favorable to one side or the other, it will get picked up. I do think it leads to judges following the law to the best of their ability. Where in other cases they might not. I don't think they have the same ability to possibly show favoritism if they were inclined to do that when cameras are rolling.
So I want to walk through, if I can, the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan case. For those who don't know, Nancy Kerrigan, set the stage for us. So Nancy Kerrigan was, she was like the gold medal favorite, I think, leading into the, and Detroit was, go ahead.
She was America's sweetheart, Nancy Kerrigan, and she was the favorite to win the gold medal. Tonya Harding was trying to make the team. And the way you did that is, you competed in these regional and national tournaments. And the national tournament just happened to have been held in Detroit on this particular week, and Nancy Kerrigan was down for a warm-up skate, and Tonya Harding was down there for a warm-up skate as well. And when Nancy Kerrigan came off the ice, someone jumped out essentially of the stands and beat her with a baton, kind of like a police baton, and injured her to the point where she wasn't able to skate.
In her leg, right?
I mean, it was kneecapped her.
Unbelievable.
They took her out.
And did she make, remind me if she made the Olympic team, she wasn't able to compete, right?
Right. No. And this all, this, as I got to think back now. I feel like she was injured, and I feel like Tanya Harding did compete in the Olympics and did not do well.
Did not do well.
And
I
then
think she ended up finishing fourth or something like, or wait.
It was,
yeah.
Yeah, it was unraveling. The case, the stories were unraveling and the case was swirling. And eventually it all came out that she was part of a conspiracy to take Nancy Kerrigan out.
And I want to hear your impression about when you first learned about the, because the Kevorkian, Dr. Kevorkian, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, who was nicknamed Dr. Death, and body was discovered on Belle Isle. I think was it in a van? Was it in his van or something like that? The old van?
Yeah, that's exactly right. He would park his van somewhere. On this particular day, the first time I covered it, one of his cases, it was on Belle Isle, and his van was left there. And this was not the first assisted suicide that Kevorkian was involved in. So I believe police, and even at this point, the public kind of knew his cars, knew his van. And so police raced out there, and there was a deceased body in the van. And
did you know his lawyer? I have connections to Jeffrey, to the Kevorkian cases, and to you, but this is the first that you and I really talked about this. Did you know Jeffrey? Did you have any contact with him prior to this case? Did you know him? And we're talking about Jeff Figer, who's one of the most well-known trial lawyers in the country and someone who certainly has utilized media coverage and television coverage of his cases to his and his clients' advantage.
At that time, I was still newer to town. While I knew who Jeffrey Figer was, I didn't know him until the Kevorkian trials. That's really where I got to know him. I actually knew Dick Thompson better because as a reporter, I would call county prosecutors' offices looking for stories, looking for cases, looking for interesting trials that were going on. So I knew Jeffrey Figer, but that's when I really got to know him. And Jeffrey Figer, I mean, he was made for TV.
TV was made for him.
TV was made for him. You couldn't get enough yes. of him. Putting a red nose on the prosecutor's photo.
I remember that. Don't you?
Clown. Oh yeah, yeah. It was unbelievable television. That's TV gold for a news reporter. To have a lead attorney like that just completely insult the lead prosecutor on the case on a national case where everyone's watching was something else.
I want to do a little bit of a deep dive on that for a second. Back then, and this is before the times are different now, obviously. There was no social media. I don't think there was cable news, if I recall correctly. Maybe there was CNN, but I don't even know. Was there CNN back then? I'm not even sure.
Yeah, probably.
But the local news and national news, the major networks and radio, you guys are it. I mean, you guys are really like the show.
Absolutely.
And the way that you would cover these cases was we'd all recognize the vans and you guys out there. And a lawyer like Jeffrey could say, how would he do it? How would he use the media in those days to get, how would he, can't send out a tweet or a little GIF on Instagram. So how would that work? How would he back then be able to get news stories and get information out to you guys?
He had favorites in the media, and he would call you. He was great. He had no problem giving you his home phone number. He was available to the media. That he wanted to be available to the media. He knew the value of having relationships in the media. So if he was planning something, and I'm sure he sat around and planned what would work, not just for the media, but for a jury, what would work in court. He knew, he was so smart. He knew what he was doing. He might just call and say, hey, you don't want to miss tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to be a big day, at the courthouse, and you'd be sure to show up, and he would not disappoint.
He's a very talented guy, and to be able to do that, and to deliver, because he was always entertaining in court. And even when he and Kevorkian would walk up, I mean, to the courthouse. Kevorkian's dressed like in a 1770s colonial, you know, but they would call press conferences.
Right.
And there would be, I mean, there would be scores of reporters and microphones and cameras out there. Right.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it was really something.
If it was a civil case, he would say, we're suing somebody for $100 million. And how do you not go cover a story, you know?
Right.
So he knew what it took to get the media to cover him, and he rarely disappointed. And he had really more free media than probably any attorney in the 30 years that I've worked here, because he worked at it. He worked for it. He knew how to entertain for the media.
I want to go back to something you said, because it relates to what you're saying about Jeffrey, and also about sources for information. For example, Dick Thompson was my original boss in the Oakland County Prosecutor's Office when I was there. But in order to get information, you were saying that you would have to call up various, you know, people in the newsmakers, I presume, or people and attempt to find out stories. So how hard was that? And did it get harder over the years or get easier?
It really depended. And it depended on how hard you worked at it. Some of us were better than others. And you know, getting information isn't always from the top guy. It's often from somebody much lower down. You know, a lot of information we would get by calling the morgue and seeing who died and start there. And then
I never even thought of that. That's pretty clever.
Yeah.
So in a morbid way, it's pretty clever.
Yeah. So. Right. The hospitals, the jails, you call the jails and you get a relationship with the people who are working the overnights at the jails. They know who came in and you would find stories. And then if you then call the prosecutor and said, look, I already have it confirmed that so-and-so is, you know, in the Oakland County Jail or the Wayne County Jail, they wouldn't lie to you, where they might not offer up information. They wouldn't hide it typically.
Kevin, so you talked about the Kevorkian cases. Do you think that Kevorkian and that case would have ended as it did if it wasn't, if cameras weren't in the courtroom, if you guys weren't able to cover it the way that you had, if the lawyers weren't able to speak with you the way that they did, if it wasn't, you know, front page news? Do you think that the cases would have ended that way, or would the issue have developed differently, in your opinion?
I don't know. It was such a big case. The TV, I felt really bad, because I think what happens with television is you get all of that attention, and then some people start to like it. And I think Jack Kevorkian himself started to like it. And I don't think if these trials were not on TV, and TV was, if there's just newspapers and not TV, I don't think Kevorkian would have tried to represent himself. I don't think he would have kept going. I think he would have listened more to his lawyer's advice about what, you know, you can and can't do and what is pushing the line. I mean, Jack Kevorkian went to jail, went to prison. That's a sad thing mm-hmm. for somebody who was in the business of trying to help people end their suffering.
So after the Kevorkian cases, obviously, you continued doing television for many years. Tell me some of the cases that you look back and look at and think you were glad you had a front row seat for or were able to cover in depth.
I tell you, my favorite court type story was not criminal at all. It was extremely interesting, and it was the George Bush and Al Gore tying in the 2000 election. You remember it was razor thin close, and nobody knew who the president was going to be. And quickly it was learned that the state of Florida was going to ultimately decide who the president was. And so I immediately jumped on a plane and headed to Florida. I didn't come back for many weeks, stayed down there through its entirety. And it was fascinating to watch these challenges to that. You had that, remember the hanging chads and the pregnant chads, and you had all the different county election officials who were counting ballots. So people are more familiar with it now because of the way we can test every election now. But then that was really the first time. And you watched it go from a county court to a state court, to the state Supreme Court, to a federal court, to the appeals court, to the Supreme Court of the United States. And it was a fascinating lesson in how the courts work and how a case is filed, how it's appealed, where it goes from there, what happens next, the strategy. And I that was really one of the most fascinating things, was being on the front lines of watching George Bush versus Al Gore in that presidential election.
So were you down in Florida that for periodically, or were you down there for an extended period of time?
Yeah, I was down there for about 6 weeks, the whole time. Yeah,
unbelievable.
So we were covering, and we'd cover this story at noon. We'd have some report about some decision that some county board made, and by 5 o'clock we'd have to drive to the state capitol because the state Supreme Court was going to take it up. It was fascinating to watch that move the way it did and unfold the way it did. It really was.
I mean, that certainly put, that was like a front row seat to not just, not even history, but a front row seat to history, like in the making, because one knew how that was going to turn out. I mean, we didn't know.
Oh no, it was fascinating. It really was. And, you know, we have a lot, we were, you know, I was, you remember the Christmas Day bomber? They nicknamed him the underwear bomber.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know, my phone rings, it's Christmas, and a member of the TSA says, you got to get to the airport. Somebody just tried to blow up a plane, you know, and suddenly the whole world again is watching, because now by this time, you know, the national news will pick up the local news. So now when you go on, I worked for NBC, so you'd go on for NBC, but NBC network would take it. So you were on nationwide doing these stories. Same with the Oklahoma City bombing. Right after the Oklahoma City bombing, they found that the suspect's brother lived in Michigan, up in the Thumb area. And so I was the first reporter up to his brother's house. I got a tip that's where the FBI was headed. I didn't think I would get there before them, but I did. And I went up to the house, looked around. Me and my photographer, it was like a 2-hour drive, so we decided, let's go hit the restroom before we go and knock on the door to try and get an interview with this guy and see what we know. We go to the bathroom, we come back, and we are right in the middle of the raid that is going on. There's 100 vehicles that have driven up from Detroit to raid this house. And they get there and the guy's not there. They're afraid that the house is rigged and that it's going to blow. And we end up in the middle of the Thumb on national TV as this whole thing is developing. And it just goes to show you that as the technology came along, how the world is suddenly everywhere in an instant. It didn't used to be that way. It might take a day or two before video got to the rest of the world. Now it's FaceTime Live. You don't have to wait for anything. You just pick your phone up, hit a button, and you're live streaming.
So, I mean, it's so true. And as you were telling that story, I was sort of trying to, it actually was sort of reliving what it was like as both the Oklahoma City bombing and what it was like in parts of the state where that's the first I had heard of, like, Michigan militia. That's where I was like, Michigan militia. For all I know, I never heard that term before. You know, I didn't know if that were like Michigan militia was like some kind of a football team or people who went out and reenacted things on Saturday. And then all of a sudden it was like, you know, the Terry Nichols and, like, you know,
right,
Michigan militia. And I'm like, what, wait, you know, that's part of that. And so it leads to my next question, which was, it seems to me that you're in a great position to sort of, I don't want to say be a judge, But to sort of judge the way the media has covered things and the way the public, particularly in most recent years, has how some people in the public have labeled things fake news, and I'm not trying to identify politics one way or the other, or don't trust the news if it doesn't come from a source that sues them. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, day in and day out, there are so many journalists out there that are working so hard to find the truth. And the, you know, sometimes you don't get to the truth right away. It might take months, it might take years, it might take decades, you know, but you're digging and searching and reporting on the truth as you know it, or as you're trying to find it. And I think that is what most journalists are doing. The problem is that with the evolution of these cable shows, you have cable shows on both sides that are agenda driven, and you have big personalities on those stations that are out there saying things. And that becomes what they're saying becomes the news, and it's not. It's opinion at best, and maybe worse, you know, they're misdirecting people intentionally for an agenda.
So, and they're competing for such a small population of, right? I mean, they're, I don't want to say they're, it's entertainment, but they're selling advertising dollars. Right. And I have both hands up. So I'm talking about, you know, both perspectives. I'm not interested getting involved in the politics here. I'm just saying that it's like, I don't want to watch any news that I don't like, so I can tune that off. I don't want to listen to any story or read anything that I don't like. And so we get echo chambers. And then the number of people that are on cable news that are still subscribing to cable that are watching cable news shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And so they're really competing, it seems like, for a very small piece of the pie. And it seems that as it happens, people just don't want to be confronted by information that they don't like. And I'm talking on both sides. Again, I'm not both sides in it. I'm just saying that
it may be a small piece of the pie, but it's very profitable, or they wouldn't have so many of them.
Yeah.
And then it's what happens with that. Suddenly someone sees that story and you're at home and you're, you like what you heard, and I don't care again, which side of it you're on. And all of a sudden you can now retweet that on your Twitter or on your Facebook, and other people can, and this information is coming, and you don't even know, you don't know where stuff comes from or what's real or what isn't. And then there's, you know, there's other websites and blogs that put stuff together that look like something you recognize, and it's not that at all. It's something different. And there's all this information coming out. So you can understand why there's so many conspiracy theories and what's going on. It's because social media has essentially made everyone with a phone or a computer a reporter. And that's not the case. Reporting is difficult work.
And they don't have a fidelity. Gerald Shargo was a well-known lawyer in New York who once said, someone said, isn't a trial a search for the truth? And he said, well, as a defense lawyer, if a trial is a search for the truth, I don't want to be, that's one party I'm not going to be a part of. And I always smiled about that because I understood the role that lawyers play in the courtroom. You know, we're advocates. As a journalist, you're not really an advocate. I mean, your job is really, I mean, you can have an opinion, but your job is to really try to be as faithful to the facts as you can be. And when you're blogging and writing and tweeting and whatever else, you know, is out there. I mean,
I think that's what journalists really strive for. Just like an attorney who's following, you know, their belief and their oath to do what's right. But the problem is that humanity gets in the way. So say one day you do a story and it's favorable to some side or somebody, and the news directors, and it got really good ratings, and the news director says, that's fantastic, we want to give you a raise, your human nature will lend you to continue down a path that you get rewarded for. I think of prosecutors' offices sometimes will see cases where they where they hold back evidence that defense attorneys should have. They're aware of things, and yet they don't disclose it because they might lose a case. And I never thought a prosecutor's job was to win all the cases. I always thought a prosecutor's job was for justice, to find out whether somebody was innocent or guilty. And so if a prosecutor's office is not handing over information because they want wins, because you need wins to get elected, then that human nature seeps in again. And what may be a great system, it becomes an imperfect system.
Absolutely. And that's well said. I do agree with you on that point about prosecutors and defense lawyers have very different, you know, they have very different roles in cases. One's job is to defend and be aggressively defend without concern for the sensibilities and sensitivities of witnesses and others. And your job is to defend without regard to what, but the prosecutor's job is, remember, when someone stands up there and they're a prosecutor, their job is to represent all the people, including the jurors, including the accused. That means that you have to do right by everybody. And that means you have to turn things over and you have to admit when you make error. I'm sure you've seen recently that case Adnan Syed, the case there's an example of somebody who was convicted, imprisoned. This was the person, am I pronouncing his name correctly? Is it Syed?
I believe it's Syed.
And he was imprisoned and was the subject of a documentary or docudrama about Serial called Serial.
Right.
And he was just released, I think, yesterday.
Yep, yesterday.
It's unbelievable. So
it's interesting. There's a case I did locally, and I don't know if you remember or not. It involved a motorist by the name of Floyd Dent, and he was pulled over in Inkster by a police officer named William Melendez.
Absolutely. I remember that case.
So I had gotten a tip that the there may be more to the story, and I went over to the courthouse, and I didn't even have a photographer. I raced over for a hearing that was taking place, and I just sat in the back, like a spectator, and I listened and watched, and they talked about this video that was from the police cars, and they said the judge said, well, I'm going to take a look at it, and in camera, so that they weren't going to play it in the courthouse. Judge was going to take a look at it, and they came out and they said, no, there's no reason to show this video to anybody. And Floyd Dent, the motorist, he was going to be charged with assaulting the police officer, cocaine trafficking or possession. And that's how that case was going down when I was sitting in that courtroom that day. And it was, they were quite frankly talking about a plea deal, what he might plead guilty to on the spot. And they didn't get that plea deal done. And I went up and talked to the defense attorney. I said, what's on that video? And they said it shows the stop and the assault that took place that day, which was an assault by the police officer on Floyd Dent, not the other way around. So I went to the judge and identified myself. I said I'd been in court. I'd listened to the whole thing. This was the same day, and that I was requesting the video and put in a Freedom of Information Act, and it changed everything. Suddenly, the video was turned over to me, and when I got to look at that video, and we saw this man pulled over and pulled, ripped out of his car, thrown to the ground, punched in the head 16 times, and then arrested. It was clear to me that the story that was about to go down in that courtroom was not the truth, not by a long shot. And by the time we were done and went through it all and everything played out, it was the police officer who went to prison for a year. And the motorist was awarded, I think, $1 million by the city of Inkster.
And that was a huge, this was before, again, for those who are sort of following at home, this was before George Floyd. Mm-hmm. This was before was this before or after Ferguson?
It was before Ferguson.
Before Ferguson. And that, so just so we're setting the, this was a case in which you got a tip, you went down to go watch just happened to hustle down there. This is a case in which a police officer who had his troubles in the city of Detroit, had left Detroit, was now policing in Inkster. Do I have that right?
And yeah, then,
yeah, and was had built a reputation as being a tough guy on the streets.
RoboCop was his nickname, yeah.
And this was a case in which you literally were there and part of the search for the truth and may have played a role, again, just in getting the truth out from changing what was about to be potentially a plea and a video potentially hidden or at least not disclosed to it being disclosed. The case against Dent, I think, ended up being dropped, yep. Right?
Right.
And then the police officer ended up being charged. And then he went to prison. Didn't he go to prison?
Yeah, he did. He went to prison for over a year.
Unbelievable. Yeah. That goes to show you how you can actually make a difference.
The media, I mean, I know a lot of people don't like lawyers. A lot of people don't like the media, but they play an important role in searching for justice and holding people accountable that are supposed to be making sure justice takes place. That sometimes they don't. Sometimes
you got an Emmy for that, didn't you? Or a Grammy or an Emmy or an Oscar or
some trophy.
You guys got something. You guys got something.
Got a trophy.
Okay. So you're on the radio now. You are the host of, or the co-host or host, along with
Tom Jordan.
And then I know I've also seen Laura Hessen. She's part of your program as well. All Talk. Yeah. So tell me, I mean, what was that transition like? I just mean in terms of you were able to work a lot of stories, or when you're on the news, you know, on television, you can maybe dive a little bit deeper. And now you're covering, I don't know how many segments you do in a 3-hour show, but you're covering a lot of subjects.
Yeah, the difference really is really just for me, the real estate. In television, the stories keep shrinking, the amount of time. If you watch a TV news story now, many are under a minute. All of them are under 2 minutes. It's very rare to see a story that goes over 2 minutes on television. So if you're trying to tell a story, TV is a tough place to tell it because you have to tell it very quickly. Or sometimes you can tell it over time. You do a 5-part series or something like that. With the radio, we have 3 hours a day, 15 hours a week, where we can really dig in a little deeper. We can also have immediate feedback from the community who can call in and contribute their thoughts to any given topic. And at this point, you know, we talk a lot about politics, policing, education, things like that. These are all really important subjects to the community. I got into the media to help the community, and I worked. I was born in Detroit, and I only wanted to work in Detroit because that's where I wanted to live, and I wanted to make a difference in the community that I live in and that I was going to raise my kids in and that they would live in. And so through television, I was able to do that. I mean, we did stories that got many laws changed and made communities safer and all kinds of things. And through the radio, I'm really trying to do that same thing. I'm trying to hold people accountable so that the community that we live in is the best community it can be. And I do think radio lends itself to investigative stories. I think that many of the stories that I have done for television are stories that could have been broken on the radio, and then maybe you would have seen them in the newspaper or on television afterwards. So that's something that we still can do, that's still available to us. And I like it. The only difference is the visual medium. We're audio on the radio, and TV is video. And some have, there's pluses and minuses to both sides of it.
So let me circle back if I can, Kevin, to, first of all, let me just say, so you're on from, is it 9 to 12?
Yep. 9 to noon, Monday through Friday.
And if anybody wanted to listen, I mean, that's obviously WJR if you're from Metropolitan Detroit.
You can do WJR.com on the internet or on your phone. You can download the WJR app, or it's 760 AM in Detroit.
And I think all of your interviews are also uploaded to
the website at WJR.com.
And they're available as individual podcasts. So there's the All Talk with Kevin and Tom. you guys are have like a each interview is on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, I think Spotify or whatever the links are. People can listen to them everywhere. So if you want to hit a particular interview, you can catch it. I was going to circle back to this if I can. So you've seen some great lawyers in court, and you probably have seen some pretty interesting moments in the courtroom. So I'm going to circle back to get your kind of a speed round from Kevin Dietz, you know, all-star, superstar, reporter, journalist, newsman, radio man. So funniest moment you've seen in the courtroom?
I would say probably Judge Vonda Evans in the Bob Becerra trial, when Bob, who was the defendant, would walk in each morning and the judge would say, "You're looking good today, Mr. Becerra."
Okay, that's a good one. I'll say best cross-examination of a witness that you can just on the fly recall. Most memorable moment, like of a lawyer cross-examining a witness. I know the one that I would think you'd say. I want to see if I'm right.
There's so many good ones.
I was going to think maybe Jeffrey with Jenny Jones was.
So I broke that story too, the Jenny Jones case. I was the first one out to that trailer home where that murder took place. And so I ended up going out to Chicago and confronting Jenny Jones on her show.
You're going to call her Jennifer Jones.
Jennifer Jones.
Jennifer, whatever her last name is.
Yeah.
So Jenny Jones.
And that was incredible. It really was. It's such a skill, and it's you can just, it can be any time, because you can just see it on the person on the stand's face when they are caught. They're just caught, you know, and the really good attorneys are good at drawing it out.
What was your take on the Kwame Kilpatrick, the case and the hubbub and, you know, everything that went on about it? What was your, you had a front row seat for that case as well. Well,
the biggest thing in that case was when the judge, he was found guilty, and this was not the federal case. This was the case when he was not paying his.
So Judge Groner.
Yeah,
right?
Judge Groner's case. Yeah. And he was not paying his restitution. And I went down to Texas and did a hidden camera story on Kwame Kilpatrick living large in South Lake, Texas, followed around with hidden cameras for a week, 10 days, showed he had all kinds of money to spend, but wasn't spending any of it paying restitution. So the judge, Dave Groner, ordered him back to court, and they went through the hearings that they had to go through, and he found him in probation violation, and he sentenced him to 18 months in prison for a probation violation. And the sheriff's deputies went over and they put the handcuffs on Kwame Kilpatrick, and Kwame turned around and looked at me and he said, "Thanks, Kevin." And I just found it extremely odd that he thought it was my fault that he was going to prison, because I had nothing to do with it.
Damn you for being resourceful and.
Yeah, all I did was document what you did. You did this to yourself. And I thought that was very, very interesting piece of that whole trial.
That's an amazing story. That's probably a great place for me to leave it. I could probably talk to you all day about this stuff. But so, Kevin, it's been great to have you here again. Kevin Dietz is a superstar, all-star, media Hall of Fame person here in Detroit, who's, as you've heard, just as broken so many stories and covered so many top stories. He's one of a kind, and you can hear him on WJR 760, the Superstation. You can catch him, you'll see him there. You can hear him. You can hear he and Tom Jordan, his co-host. They've got great guests. Full disclosure, I'm occasionally on there when they need some space to fill. But they've got great guests, newsmakers, top, and they give, like he said, it'll give you, it's got 6 to 8 or 9 minutes for a segment with some of these guests. So they get a chance to to get in depth with them on some of the top news breaking stories as they're happening. That's probably the maybe one of the phrases for another radio station, but news as it's happening. But Kevin, it's been really great to have you here. It's been my honor. It's been too long. We talked about doing this for a while, and I'm just so glad that you were able to join us. This is Kevin Dietz on the Killer Cross-Examination Podcast. I'm Neil Rockhine. Subscribe, like, follow, and we'll see you next time.